Welcome to Just Verdicts with your host, Brendan Lupitin, a podcast dedicated to the pursuit of just verdicts for just cases. Join us for in-depth interviews and discussions of cutting-edge trial strategies that will give you the keys to conquering the courtroom. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Greetings, fellow legal minds. You may have noticed a change. We are now Just Verdicts. Formerly Trial and Medical Error, our podcast is undergoing a transformation. We're zeroing in on what truly matters, the strategies, stories, and mindset behind remarkable jury verdicts. Please join me as we dissect the anatomy of legal triumphs, spotlighting the lawyers, jurors, and narratives that shape courtroom outcomes. From pivotal cases to insider insights, we're here to fuel your passion for the law. So, to all trial lawyers seeking inspiration and knowledge, welcome to Just Verdicts, where every verdict holds the keys to success. Hey, so I'm psyched to be here today with Tom Crenny and James Tallman, who are going to talk to us today about an awesome verdict they got recently in maybe, although who knows, I would say arguably the toughest or certainly top five toughest counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to get a medical malpractice verdict, or probably any verdict for that matter. So Tom and James, really appreciate you guys getting here. A lot of the people that are going to be listening or watching the podcast already know who you guys are because a lot of our friends listen to this. But for anybody listening who doesn't, you know you guys personally or know you reputationally, and I'll just go by left to Tom, can you kind of give us a little intro about yourself, how you became a trial lawyer, and what took you to wind up trying cases in what's affectionately referred to as Vietnam?
I ended up in Vietnam for a large part of my career because I was a Methodist minister in Fayette County, and I went to seminary at Northwestern, and the United Methodist Church has an Episcopal structure, by which I mean the bishop sends you wherever he sends you and you go. And he sent me to Masontown, Pennsylvania, which is part of Fayette County. And that was way back in 1973. And I was a parish minister for 6 years, and it wasn't right for me. And I could have sold insurance or gone to law school. So I wanted to avoid really going to work as long as I could. So I went to night school, during which time I was a domestic relations hearing officer in Fayette County. And that is the barbed wire of the law, I can tell you that. Most of the litigants had guns. I was the only one without a gun. That was a wild time. But I got to know a lot of people, and I lived down there for 10 years. And consequently, when I came out of law school, I was almost 37. I got a lot of cases from my days down there. So that's how I ended up trying a lot of cases in Fayette County.
Tom, before we pivot to James, it's really interesting that you were a minister. Do you believe that the public speaking component of that, you know, occupation lent itself to you then later becoming a trial lawyer?
I don't know about public speaking, but it's a people job, isn't it? And I think to do this job well, you have to be good with people. And I think that's part of it. There are a surprising number of lawyers who end up at the end of their career in the ministry or in social services, at least. So they go from lawyers to that end. Not as many who did what I did, which was go from being a preacher to a lawyer. But they are similar in lots of ways, yeah.
Awesome. James, how about you, man? How did you get to this point in your career where you're trying med-mal with Tom up or over in, I guess, Fayette County?
Yeah, thank you, Brendan. One thing I just wanted to mention with Tom, he didn't mention this, he has a theatrical performance, which, of course, lends itself to being a trial lawyer as well. So I think that theater background helps in presentation. I do not, but for me personally, I've been practicing since 1996. Started off in big law with Kirkpatrick and Lockhart, did that for a while, other business firms in Pittsburgh, and then had the opportunity to shift gears, and personal injury seemed appealing to me. It was an opportunity to do something different than, there's nothing wrong with working at Kraftner Lockhart or big law firms, of course, but you're shifting millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars between Fortune 100 companies, as opposed to trying to help individuals and have a real impact on people. So that appealed to me. And I've been working with Tom ever since I moved over into personal injury. I was with the firm for a while. Now I'm not with the firm, but we will collaborate on lots of matters together. So that's how I ended up becoming a personal injury traveler.
So how do you two, I assume you both have tried cases together before this, right?
We have. And one of the problems that I have is I've never known very much about the law.
You and me both.
And I mean it. And James knows a lot. He is someone that has helped me in that regard time and time again. And he really takes care, to a very large extent, that part of the efforts that we're making.
And that's a huge part. When you say that, Tom, that resonates with me because I feel very kind of similar. Like I just love the trial stuff. And if I could just do the trial part, I'd be the happiest guy in the world. But here there's all this other stuff that goes into giving your clients the best shot at trial. So it's good to find somebody like James that it kind of balances, you guys balance each other out. At trial, have you guys, since you tried so many cases together, sort of found what works best for you as far as who does what during the actual trial?
It varies from case to case, but James does an awful lot of the work. It goes beyond just the law, what he's doing, but that he has to do all by himself. But he does lots of the witnesses and we work together. I'm getting old. Well, I need lots of help.
No, I'm with you. And have you guys, you know, before you started collaborating, trying cases together, did you ever go through that period where you tried cases all by yourself?
I did. And pretty tough. Really tough, I think. And the legal end, I think, suffered when I did that. It suffered. And, you know, there was a time when I first started, I just did not realize the importance of the charge. I didn't really fully appreciate that as a young lawyer.
Well, this reminds me of my first personal injury trial. I had done some commercial type cases, trials with other firms, but with Tom, it was a slip and fall in Fayette County that I actually, it was not a very large verdict, but it was one slip and fall in Fayette County. Woman fell at a Dollar General. That was my first personal injury trial. And I did that one all by myself with a paralegal to help, but that was one that I did.
The first thing you try to do, of course, in Fayette County is get the case out of Fayette County. That is job one. And we have had two verdicts against Uniontown Hospital. And really, as far as I know, those are the only verdicts ever against the Uniontown Hospital. And we had one about 15 years ago. It was cases Monastorsky, and it was a $2.3 million verdict. But it was in federal court because the U.S. attorney was kind enough to remove it from Fayette County because one of the defendant doctors was at a federal government agency practicing. It was Centerville Clinic. And so, you know, he said, well, I'm going to take this out of it. He got it into federal court in the Western District. And of course, we couldn't believe how lucky we were. And that ended up being a very nice verdict for us. But this is the first one in Fayette County.
Now, before we jump into the case, and I want to hear the details, what do you think? There at times have been, I've heard some lawyers say, oh, jurisdiction doesn't matter, people are people. And then you hear other people that are very staunchly of the position that the jurisdiction, the venue where you try your case matters a great deal. And I mean, look no further than the sort of epithet of how Fayette is referred to for trial lawyers as Fayette-Nam. Clearly, I think we all would agree that Fayette County is a tougher place then to try and win a case as a plaintiff than Allegheny County. And I guess my question to either of you would be, what do you think that is? What do you think accounts for the difference? Is it just the socioeconomic issues, or are there some other cultural takes on things that make it tougher for us?
Well, you know what I'd like to jump to? I'm not going to directly respond to that because something else that's been on my mind that I heard, I think it was John Perry talked about the Trump jurors. And I hadn't heard that term, but maybe this verdict is an example of that. And I don't know if you want to address that.
No, let's talk about it. What's on your mind about it?
Well, I just whether these people that are enamored with Trump, and there are a lot of them, for instance, in Fayette County. I think he won that county real, real big. I'm not sure what the numbers were. But generally speaking, people want to get experts, want to rebel, raise hell. And are there people that when WVU took over Uniontown Hospital, did that bother them? Are there Trump jurors in the jury that we had? I don't know. It'd be a hard thing to know, but it's something that interested me when I heard it discussed, that in these rural counties, that sort of phenomena might be taking place. I'd be interested in what you think, Brendan. I think you have a little more experience, to say the least, then.
Well, I don't know if I all my more experience, but I kind of nerd out on a lot of these different trends. And it seems across the country that mostly corresponding with the timing of the pandemic, that it has become a better time for trying plaintiff cases of all kinds. And some of the thought processes that I've heard that may explain that, you know, does have something to do with the Trump juror, the Trump contingent of being very anti-establishment, anti-elitist. And then when you're talking about these Med-Mal cases, and generally, as they should be, doctors are held in high regard. I mean, doctors are doing good for the most part. They mean to do well. They're trying to take care of us and so forth. We all rely on doctors. But I think that some of that, whether it's the anti-Fauci effect, the anti-vaccine and don't force masks down my throat concept, fed into all of that for why those jurors who traditionally, I think we look at them as sort of hyper-conservative, if that, and they may even be off on some other part of the political spectrum, but whatever it is that kind of makes them identify so strongly with Donald Trump may make them in a bizarre way helpful jurors to us, plaintiff lawyers in the right cases, but maybe almost in anticipated ways that they don't like the doctors. They perceive these quote experts as elitists trying to tell them how to live their life and so forth. And so they're going to disregard a lot of that stuff and maybe just try to stick it to the side they feel is trying to ram stuff down their throats. But I think you're right, Tom, that there's definitely that, there's something about that phenomena going on out there, whether it's starting to water down. I think during the height of the pandemic, I think that was really happening strongly. But I think like everything, trends kind of come and go and so forth. And you know, it's weird that traditionally, I think conservative jurors have been thought to be not the best jurors for us in cases. But on the other hand, there's reasons to think that conservative jurors may be better when we have really strong liability cases because they are going to be more sort of exacting in the damages. That, look, if you broke the rules, we're going to hold you fully accountable. We're not going to, because now we don't feel as kind of sympathetic for your type of thing. But I don't know. A lot of times it's hard to say. I still think it's very case by case specific and issue specific and so forth. I don't know if any of that made any sense. But so enough about me pontificating. I want to talk about the facts of this case. So can one of you kind of give us a summary of how the case came to you? What happened in a nutshell, so to speak, to get us up to speed?
The case came to me from a longtime referral in Brownsville. Its name's Herb Mitchell. And it involved a 35-year-old mother of two, divorced, who was having abdominal issues and went in for a lap chole. It was supposed to be same-day surgery, and the surgeon, she suffered an insult to the portal vein, and he admitted he had hit the portal vein, and it was a very significant bleed, and he also attempted to repair it. And what happened is he followed her for two or three days in the hospital, but then discharged her. And 10 days later, she hemorrhaged, bled out, and died. 35 years old, two kids, really strong liability case. So we got that case and got it to trial as quickly as we could. That was the case. She had two minor, both of those testified, by the way.
So that's a real tragedy, just a horror story of a nightmare scenario for the non-med mal practitioners. So this was a, when you say a lap chole, this is a laparoscopic procedure. Doctor goes in using instruments through small holes in the abdomen, camera and so forth, and does everything kind of inside without making the big incision, right?
That's correct. Not a laparotomy, although he did have to open her up to do the repair. So he converted to a laparotomy. That was not the intention. She was supposed to go home that night.
The entire procedure was, I mean, those procedures are thought to be relatively routine. They're removing the gallbladder, right?
Absolutely routine. That's all it was. It was a gallbladder operation. None of this was anticipated. The doctor testified that he had done thousands in his career and had never, never injured the portal vein. He acknowledged that. Same with everybody else involved in the case, including his partner, who so testified at his deposition, although his partner did not appear at trial.
And what did you think was the significance of that? Just that that showed in and of itself what a total outlier event this was? I mean, because still, can't they argue complication of the procedure, even if it is an injury in that area?
And they did. That's exactly what they did. Lo and behold, when we talked to the jury, they agreed with that part of the defense, which was just a shock to us. Absolutely were floored by that. And what they said was, we were upset that he didn't repair sufficiently the wound that he had made. And also another matter, which was, he did not view the preoperative CAT scan. He didn't bother to look at it. It had no significance in terms of causation, which the defense lawyer pointed out in his opening and said, we'll show you this didn't matter. But it mattered to the jury. They didn't like it, and they told us that afterward, too. That was a big deal.
One issue, in follow-up to that issue of the CT scan, I think it all kind of flowed to this idea that the doctor did not care about Danielle Robeson as a patient. He's the hospital doctor. He's thrust upon her. She has no choice in it. She goes in a couple of weeks before, about 10 days or so before she actually has the procedure, having some problems, and goes for the ER, sees a PA. The PA says, hey, if you want, we can do this today, or like tomorrow, or you can come back in about a week and a half or so. She opts to come back in about a week and a half. She never sees Dr. Vanek, shows up, goes into the OR, and I don't even know if she sees him before the surgery, but maybe at some point, but he does the procedure. He sees her a little bit in the hospital, but really it was the PA. And we were able to lay that out, that the doctor ignores the CT scan preoperatively. Postoperatively, he wants to look at it and say there were some issues. And then on top of that, the PA is doing 95% of the patient contact. And I think that resonated with the jury, that it showed a lack of just caring by the doctor. And when he testified on the stand, I don't think he helped himself very much either. I don't think he was particularly sympathetic.
By the way, we are not saying that he did not care about his patient. We are saying that, and I'm sure that's what James means, that he may have given that impression.
Sure. Well, and you need that. I mean, the jury to find the doctor responsible for causing such a horrible tragedy like this. I mean, you guys are obviously not saying he didn't care. He cared, but to the jury's perspective, when a doctor or whomever just doesn't kind of do those basic aspects of the care that they're expecting would be done by the doctor, it just kind of puts a stain a bit on the doctor's approach totally. And I guess my question to you is, you knew that not looking at the CT before, for example, was not causative necessarily of what happened. But did you have a strong feeling that it would reflect negatively on the doctor kind of overall?
We did. And the reason for that is that he brought it back into the case by stating that the CT showed that the portal vein abutted with the infundibulum, which is the bottom of the gallbladder. And that was not the case. Nobody thought that. But he claimed that once this bleed occurred, He then went and looked at the film for the first time right after the operation. And he suggested in his deposition, no wonder I hit the portal vein. It's abnormally close to the infundibulum. Well, that wasn't true. That was not the case. By the way, the jury never cared about any of that. I thought it was a big deal. I thought hitting the portal vein was a big deal. When we talked to them, they said, we don't care. It's okay that caused the problem, but he should have repaired it properly.
On cross-examination at trial, when asked about, has he changed his practice? Has he learned from this? He said no. So despite the fact that every other doctor said you should read, even his partner said you should read the CT scan preoperatively, he says he doesn't typically do that, and nothing's changed.
There's an interesting nuance in what you guys are talking about here, which is the jury cared about the fact that he didn't look at the pre-op CT. They didn't care that he hit the portal vein during the procedure. However, did they care that, or was there a thought voiced by any of the jurors that, well, per his own words, had he looked at the CT ahead of time, he may have avoided hitting the portal vein?
Yes, because that's what he claimed.
Okay. And so that was significant. You guys know realistically, in reality, that had nothing to do with it. However, in the way that the doctor tells the story, I didn't look at the CT. And when I later looked at the CT, if I had looked at it, I would have seen this. And he almost kind of incriminated himself with it, even though it wasn't reality, so to speak.
Well, this is all coming back to me. I never understand the case until it's just immediately over, right at the end of the trial.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
I understand the trial. And I forgot a lot of this. It hasn't been very long. But that's exactly one of the things that he said. This is amazing at his depo. He said, if I had known how close the portal vein was to the infundibulum, I might have been more careful. Now, he made that statement on the record. And of course, we did pound away at that, that he might have been more careful. And I think maybe I can't remember if anybody commented on that when we talked to the jury, but I mean, that's right out of his own mouth. I might have been more careful.
Yeah, absolutely. And James, I remember you when I was asking you about the case a little bit after the PAJ MedMal seminar, you had explained that your theory of negligence was not really so much that he was negligent for hitting the portal vein, despite how crazy unusual that complication is, but you guys were focused more on the negligence of the repair. Is that a large part of the thrust, or am I misunderstanding that?
Actually, it was probably a little bit more the other way around going into it, is that we had focused a lot on the liability that the injury to the hepatic portal vein was just such a gross negligent act. But as it turns out, I think there was more jury appeal for the failure to repair it properly.
Was there testimony on that? Did you get any testimony that it had to have been done improperly for this to occur?
Yeah, maybe James, you could tell them about Dr. Gates and how he was presented. And we divided our experts up. One talked about hitting the portal vein, and then the other, Dr. Gates, talked about the problems with repair. Maybe you could talk about that, James.
Dr. Gates talked about the repair. He was a very good witness, and I think he was being cross-examined. And he was able to carry off the cross very effectively, I thought. But we presented him in a unique fashion. He was not able to come to trial in person. We thought he was going to. And then when we found out he wasn't, we thought, well, we'll travel up to where he's up in Connecticut, I believe. And then AJ from Network Deposition says, well, we can put up a big screen and have him testify by Zoom remotely. And Dr. Gates is, I don't know how old he is, but he's, gray hair, not ruled, but just has a lot of gravitas the way he presents himself. Plus, he's on this giant screen with a wall of plaques behind him. And his presentation was the best I've ever seen of any expert witness. Not only was he a good witness the way he testified, but that presentation was significant. And we learned from the jury that had a big impact on them.
And this was the expert talking about the repair issues.
Correct.
And what was his criticism exactly?
Well, it's almost Ray Sipson, right, Junior?
Yeah, exactly.
Like what happened to her can't happen unless this was not repaired correctly.
He also said that he repaired it while the bleed was ongoing, and that he should have stopped the bleed and then made a repair, and he could have seen better. That he did not feel that the area of the insult was really visible to the surgeon. And so that was one aspect of his technical approach of which he was critical.
Let me just put a finer point on what, James, you were just explaining, how you presented Dr. Gates's testimony. So I have toyed with that at times when you're worried that your expert can't come in live, but maybe we can get them in via video feed. But then you worry, what if there's some big technical issue with that? I haven't done it. And it sounds like you guys having done it, it worked out really well for you. The way it looked, the way it came across, were there any technical issues? Would you do it again?
Yes, absolutely. We were concerned about that because the judge kept telling us, we have the worst Wi-Fi. He said, there's something about this building. If you're on one side of the building, you get good reception. On our side of the building, you don't. And AJ from Network Depositions had his own connection, his own network Wi-Fi connection. And it was very stable. He checked it ahead of the trial, and then he checked it the day, minutes before Dr. Gates testified. He checked with him again to make sure it was stable. There were two or three very brief seconds, a couple seconds where the screen froze, but it was very, very brief. So there were no real, I would say there was no technical glitch at all.
AJ did a tremendous job for us, and he kept telling us not to worry. And of course, as you suggested, I was very worried. I had a case, I think it was in 2017, where my deceased plaintiff, who I had put on video, that the whole system failed. And the judge was a visiting federal court judge. If I could remember his name, I would say it. But he was nasty. He would not let us fix it and present it later. We did not get to put her on. And I think that was bad. So I was very nervous about it, but it was spectacular. It was like he was right there with these jurors. I mean, it was super effective.
I think a lot of people would be really interested to know that and potentially use that. I like the idea of just mixing up your presentations in person. If you could add that too, have a video here for plug and play, but just rounding it out from a two little technical questions on it. Number one, was it set up such that to get it all set up and have the doctor on the screen, jury's out of the room, and when they come in, he's kind of sitting there on the screen almost as if he's ready to testify, like in the stand? Or did you like turn him on when the jury was there?
Turn him on.
Wow. Okay.
Is that right, James?
He was the first witness of the day, so it worked out. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And then two, could he see the courtroom?
I don't know the answer.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's the only thing I'd be wondering. Could he see back, or is he just talking to the void, so to speak?
I think it was like a typical Zoom connection where he had a laptop sitting there. I think he did, yeah.
And then calling up exhibits, if you needed to with him, you would just, the normal way, you'd call them out and the tech would pull them up on his screen. He could see them and so forth.
Absolutely.
Okay, very cool.
And they could be presented with him side by side. I mean, it could not have gone better. It was one of those directs. George Burns always said he made a living for 25 years by saying to Gracie Allen, how's your uncle? And that was his job. That's all he did. And it was one of those kinds of directs. I said to Dr. Gates, how's your uncle?
Yeah, he's off and running.
Yeah.
I love those experts. So let me go kind of rewind a little bit, okay? You're going to trial. Can you walk me through what, if any, jury selection process there was in Fayette?
This gives me the cue to tell this wonderful story. In the array was one of our former clients, a marvelous woman, and we had made a recovery 30 years ago for her children, actually, her two kids, of $9 million. And she is in the array. And so when they ask her if she knows anybody, she says, yeah, she knows us. And the judge says, well, can you be fair and impartial? And of course, she said what they all say, or most do, unless they want to go home. She said, yes, I can be fair and impartial. So defense counsel is not sure what to do. I know this because he did not strike her until he got to his last strike. So he is thinking, maybe she hates those guys.
Amazing.
Maybe we got to keep her on the jury because she may not like those guys. And boy, would that have been wonderful. But they finally struck her. When they got their last strike, they had to strike her. Too bad.
Yeah, too bad is right. Although you guys did all right with it. So
we didn't get to talk to any jurors. James, you can comment on
what happened.
Yeah, it was a unique experience in my trial experience, the way it happened. There was no colloquy with the judge about our proposed voir dire. We had provided proposed voir dire, but we had no discussion with him about it. Judge Wagner came out and just said, I've received your voir dire. I've made my decisions as to what I'm going to ask. And then he just proceeded to do it. And it went very quickly. He said it was going to go quickly, and it did. And when he was done, he immediately read one instruction about note-taking and then said, counsel, open. And it was very unexpected. I think we started around 9 o'clock, and I think the opening was 11:30 or so, opening started.
Did you guys get to submit any proposed voir dire questions ahead of time?
We did.
Without being too critical, were there any questions of sufficient substance that gave you any insight whatsoever on these participants for who to pick for your jury?
No, I can't remember.
There were as you would expect, there were a lot of people that had connections to the healthcare, the WVU, to the doctors that were defendants in the case or part of the case. So there were a lot of questions about that and then follow-up questions about that. So we had to exclude those people for the most part. But a few questions about personal experience with personal injury cases that I think led to the defense striking some people. But it was a lot of just, you're kind of guessing about the way the person's dressed and do they look like they're in a good mood or a bad mood. I mean, really, it's a shame, but it's not a particularly insightful process.
How about the questionnaire? Was there a questionnaire at all that gave you any somewhat information in the background about them?
No.
Was there a questionnaire, John?
We kept asking about the standard, the actual state rule that has those basic questions that are usually covered by a questionnaire, and there wasn't one.
So pretty much flying blind and picking this group of people.
Absolutely.
So you immediately had to jump into opening statement, which sounds like the judge had not really necessarily told you that was going to happen. But give us a summary of the opening, James or Tom?
I did.
So Tom, give us a summary of how you approach the opening. Are you a long opening guy, a short opening guy? What's your basic format? How do you go about it?
No more than 20 minutes. If I'm doing it right, I keep it as simple as I can. I can remember years and years ago, I was at the NIDA trial school, and I did my practice opening, of course, for one of the professors. And he said to me, Tom, that was great, but you're not addressing the Democratic National Convention, because, you know, it was 1 hour. It was like the Cross of Gold speech. So I have managed to pull back from that kind of presentation. And I think the best thing is to concentrate on what you think is the key. We are going to prove that. And you will see that that is so. Not because I say it's so, because that's what the evidence will show. So very simple, very short.
Do you spend much time inoculating or undermining the most obvious or anticipated defenses? Or are you more just focused on what you are going to prove in your case?
Yeah, I didn't think there were a whole lot of defenses in this case. So I would say, especially in this case, you know, that depends on what the facts are. If you think there is something in particular, I didn't think they had much. And I was impressed, by the way, with defense counsel's opening. It was at least an hour. And the other thing you learn, of course, is you surely are never going to object to defense's opening, almost no matter what he says. And this lawyer at one point said that we would twist the truth. I sat and let that go. But he did a really good job saying how hard it is. He did. It's dark in there, the facts. It's a very tough job. And the doctor does this. It was a real long, effective throwing of things on the wall, which is what he had to do.
We don't have to go into last names. Was it Dave or Dan that gave the opening?
It was Dave, and he was very good.
Gotcha.
He is very good.
He's been doing it a while.
He's good at it.
So how are you feeling after openings are done? I mean, were you feeling like you were satisfied despite a good opening by defense or on the fence? I mean, did you think you were in the lead at that point?
No, I was scared the whole time, but I had emphasized what I thought was the key, which is that he hit this portal vein, and I said, you will talk to 6-7 doctors who've done these kinds of things, and none of them have ever done this. And I thought that was the key. And as I said to you at the outset, turned out it was not. We thought if there was a weakness, it was the repair part of the case.
Yeah.
That was our weakness.
And I felt after the opening, the one thing that struck me that they emphasized more than I expected, and at one point the judge even commented outside the jury at a break at one point about it, it was this idea that there was some electrical arcing, that the equipment somehow electricity, a charge flew out of the pool in a cartridge device and damaged, and without striking anything else, without hitting any other vessels or ducts, hit the hepatic portal vein. And it was the kind of argument that was really, he emphasized it a lot in the opening, a lot, and more than certainly more than I expected. And it was the kind of defense that I could see a jury who wants to give a doctor a pass saying like, well, how can you control an arcing? The equipment malfunctions or something, you know, that's not really his fault. And I know the judge at one point made some comment about it. Well, if they believe the arcing theory, who knows what they'll do? But ultimately, it went away through the course of expert testimony, really. And Dr. Vinnick himself didn't help on that. He actually said there was no arcing.
Yeah, I was going to say, wouldn't he have disclosed that in his deposition or
what? Tom did a great job of pointing out that there was no. Yeah, he should have. And there was nothing in the operative report. And Tom did a great job of emphasizing that.
What a weird defense. So,
yeah, he was a real good case. Yeah, we're just in the wrong county.
So
it was a real good liability case.
It sounds like it. Obviously, a travesty of the outcome. So just kind of continuing on with order of proof and how the case unfolded, you talked about the really interesting way and effectiveness of Dr. Gates. Can you talk to me about what were some other kind of key moments in the case you thought, whether it was after the fact you realized or during, that you felt kind of further turned the tides in your favor?
Their expert was not very good. And they may have had some difficulty finding someone, I don't know, because when we did research on their expert, we found that a lot of his practice was as a bariatric surgeon. And so when I crossed him, I showed all the pictures of his office, which he claimed wasn't really his office. His other office was in the hospital. But we showed his office where he did his bariatric work. And there were signs up that they were giving away free stuff in there and, you know, lose weight. And then his CV had a list of 20 or 30 bariatric presentations. They weren't the articles he wrote. He wrote articles about his gallbladder experience, but it's not my job to pay attention to that. I went to the presentation section, and the presentation section was 20 or 25 presentations on bariatric weight loss. And we just hit that pretty hard, and the jury didn't notice that.
That this guy was not really, this was not his territory, so to speak.
It sure didn't appear that way. He claimed it was, but the video or the pictures of his office were, I think, affected.
Ah, interesting. And what was his, I mean, Dr. Gates gets up there, says, this just doesn't happen. The fact that this woman hemorrhaged out this way is evidence, like you said, it just was negligence. I mean, there was no way that this couldn't have been negligence for this to have occurred. How did he respond to it?
You remember that, James? I don't exactly remember what he said.
Yeah, I mean, I think he just testified that that injury to the hepatic portal vein is something that happens. There were attempts to introduce articles from China, India, that I think that probably also did not help him. And without trying to be too xenophobic, I think they were certainly saying the effect of you had to go to China and India to find examples. And it wasn't even clear from these studies and they weren't even really studies. They were more just reports of outcomes at a particular hospital. And you had to go that far outside of the U.S. system to find examples of the hepatic portal vein being injured by itself, not where you have other catastrophic injuries happening and then maybe the hepatic portal vein's injured, but something just that alone. And he just tried to say that it's a known risk, it's a known outcome, it does happen, and it does happen in the United States. And he tried to make that argument, and obviously the jury didn't buy it. With regard to the repair, I think he didn't do a particularly good job on that. I don't think he said a whole lot except that it just repaired properly, two sutures, and there's nothing more. It was just something that there was no way to know that it was going to fail. There was no way to prevent it and see it because she had, over the course of 10 days between the surgery and her death, 10 days had passed and she was improving. There was no evidence. There was no ongoing bleed. It wasn't as if she was slowly bleeding out. It was her test results, her lab results were going in the direction you would hope for somebody recovering from a massive blood loss and surgery. And then all of a sudden it just burst.
Yeah, that's right. He did make that point.
The damages, as you guys described in the summary of the case, kind of speak for themselves. But what kind of damage claim did you make? For example, was there an economic loss claim here? And secondarily, what witnesses and how did you frame the loss in the case, given this is a wrongful death type case?
Yeah, so just as a general, more generally speaking, we started the case off, we focused, but the first witnesses were family members and friends, and it was emphasizing her life and who she was as a person. That's how the case started. And then it moved into liability and then ultimately an economic expert. And we had the debate about personal maintenance, and that was a big part of it. But the reality is that our client did not have a particularly high paying job. She worked part time. So there wasn't a huge wage loss claim, but we did go forward with it. And we had also loss of household services. And we had between the two numbers, it was moderately for Fayette County. We thought it was not too small to put on in front of them. It did become a big issue with the judge about personal maintenance and the reduction. We reduced the present value, but personal maintenance was not taken out, was not taken into consideration. And that was a big debate about the jury instruction permit, you know, require personal maintenance or the deduction or not. And does the note in the jury instruction trump the actual language of the jury instruction? And we went all around that. And our expert testified and talked about why he did not deduct for personal maintenance, was allowed to testify about it. At the point that he testified, we thought their economic expert, was going to testify. They opted not to have an economic expert. So after he was done, we were left with the scenario of he testified somewhat on direct, and then on cross, he was questioned about personal maintenance. He explained it. There was a big debate about was he allowed to put up the jury instruction on the wall and say, this is why I did it this way on the screen, and the judge circumscribed what we were allowed to say as far as how much we could talk about the jury instruction being sort of the law of Pennsylvania. But ultimately, he was allowed to say that he, you know, didn't deduct personal maintenance because there was a jury instruction that told him not to. And then they had no expert saying anything else. So at the end of the trial, it became an issue as to should his testimony be stricken? Was it really proper? And because Judge Wagner ultimately said that he thought, despite the note and the commentary about personal maintenance not being deducted in an MCARE case, he said the jury instruction does talk about it. And he pulled out some unreported case from a few years ago that claimed that it should be allowed. It was a back and forth with the defense, but because they didn't have another expert, their own expert, he just said it's a jury question and left it to the jury, which was kind of an odd way to handle it. I thought, but yeah, it ended up being just sort of for the jury, and the defense was not happy about that. But at the end of the day, the jury came back with a modest lump sum. They didn't divide it up between loss of household services or lost income or pain and suffering. They just said $250 for survival.
Was that how much the total was, or was that less than the total?
That was less than the total.
Interesting. Did you get any feedback for why they did it that way?
No, they didn't say anything about it. The judge as I understood it, James, he let the defense argue, and I thought he instructed the jury that it should be reduced to present value and they should take into account personal maintenance.
That was the instruction.
That was the instruction by the court, and that left us at about zero.
Wow. Interesting. So regarding the sort of condition witnesses talking about your client before and after, did you do before and after, like what life is like now compared to what it was, that kind of stuff? I mean, what did you try to highlight and stress to make the connection on the damages, the loss of everything, loss of this woman's life to her family?
We had several witnesses that did a very nice job on the damage end, that Danielle was a wonderful mother, that she enjoyed life. She loved her kids. And while she was divorced, she was back living with the husband that she divorced. And so he was the one that was raising these two kids after she died. But even before she died, they were living together as a family. And so while we couldn't...
He didn't have his own claim.
Yeah, no, he had no claim. And this complicated our economic claim, but it helped in terms of how the jury felt about the whole case and her loss of life. And, you know, even though that's not part of the law, I think the jury feels that. I think we all know that this person has lost their life. And even though that's not strictly recoverable under the law, I think that, of course, enhances the feeling about the person. If we can show that they had a great life and were wonderful people. And she was. She was a great gal.
How did you argue for damages in closing?
The old-fashioned way, which is that she lost everything and the kids lost their mother. How do we measure that? That's a hard job for you. I just say that, even though that's not strictly an element of damage, that everything that there is to have, to hold, and to do, to know.
Yeah.
She lost.
And I mean, did she get life expectancy in there? What her life expectancy would have been?
Yeah, we did. And, you know, if somebody wants to jump up and holler, that's not the law in Pennsylvania. Have to it. And, of course, Mr. Johnson's far too smart to do that. You know, we had a lot of wonderful photos of her. We had no movies. But we had a lot of wonderful photos, lots of wonderful friends. And her brother, I thought, was great. He was a big, strong, tough, hardworking guy. And he broke down the stand. For Fayette County, it was a lot of money.
Well, how much was it?
Total of $1 million.
So if I'm doing my math right, they do $250 for economic loss and then $750 for wrongful death survival, basically?
Yeah. And we had hoped to get a lot more, but I'll tell you what, the jury was only out 50 minutes. We thought we lost. That usually means, to me, my experience. So after you go through a whole week like that, you become grateful for what you got.
Well, look, I mean, we talked at the beginning of they're not handing out big verdicts in Fayette County. And everybody on the listserv, you know, on the MedMal listserv, when they heard that it's a $1 million verdict in Fayette County, I mean, everybody was blown away by that, as they should. I mean, you take your venue as the case comes to you. I mean, I think it's an amazing verdict. Was it broken down, the $250 economic, did they break down between survival and wrongful death, or was it just $250 and $750?
I mean, there was no further breaking down of that verdict. What we've tried to acknowledge here in this discussion with you is that it was a very good case. And that jury thought they gave us the world. They thought they were doing wonderful things. And what can you do? Still Fayette County.
It is. And $1 million is a ton of money everywhere, but in particular in outlying counties like Fayette. Was there any discussion? Did anybody share with you their thought process? I mean, probably it was as simplistic as they figured the economic out $250 and we'll do some type of multiple because I don't know what else you do to get to $1 million
and call it. What happened was, so we had a lot of discussion, good debate over the course of 2 days at least on the verdict slip. And we had lines and we had all of the elements of wrongful death. And then we had for survival action, economic loss, and then pain and suffering, we had specific line. And the judge ultimately went our way and gave us the verdict slip that we wanted and had all the breakdown and all the lines. The jury ignored it. They just literally wrote 750 and 250. And the defense counsel wanted to know what they were thinking, particularly with the economic loss. They wanted to see if there was some appealable issue on the personal maintenance. And the foreperson was just like, well, we all had our pieces of paper and kind of notes, but I don't know what people were thinking. We just kind of spitballed it and came up with a number. I mean, she had no insight whatsoever as to how they came up with the 750. And the judges let it go at that.
And of course, the judge sent him out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I begged him not to do it, and they were ready to go home. That's the way it is in our business, you know.
Right. They wanted to get it done. Yeah. I think liability was probably fairly easy. And then they just wanted to get it done after that.
Yeah. It must have been 50 minutes for a full deliberation. Must have been almost an instantaneous. Everybody agreed on liability. And then it was just coming up with the number. Now, if you had all those lines and they're all left blank, basically, from what you're telling me, does that create some type of a appealable issue that they have to award or do something on those lines, or not necessarily?
I think with regards to wrongful death, they don't have to. But I think arguably with regard to the survival action, they could have been ordered back to go back and to deliberate and come up with a number. And they came up and wanted to talk, had a sidebar with the judge about that issue. There was a question to the foreperson. The foreperson just said, we had no breakdown, and that was the end of it. Fortunately, the judge did not send them back to go further or have any further deliberations, but I think he could have. Whether he should have or not, at this point, there's no appeal file in, that issue's gone. But I think arguably under the law, with regards to the survival action, they could have been forced
to go back. Yeah, it's really interesting. So we're wrapping up here, guys, and this has been really very interesting to see how this all unfolded. As you look back on it, I know it's a super unfair question to say, well, what would you do differently now? Because it sounds like the case went your way really well. I mean, you get a 50-minute deliberation, a Med-Mal, and they find in your favor, and that's about as good as it gets as far as the case that you put on. I mean, is there anything that you think you would have done differently or anything like that? Or what's your biggest takeaways from it?
Rented a bus and driven that case to Philadelphia.
Right. I'd do that to all mine too. No, it really does sound like you guys put a hell of a case on and you had them dead to rights. Last question. When you crossed the defendant doctor, how did you approach it? What was your tone, Tom, with him?
Not cordial, but polite. I don't think that it is a good idea to attack him. I can remember saying right off the top, doctor, let's make sure the jury understands this. This is a wound that you caused. This happened during the surgery, and it's because you caused it. And he acknowledged that. But just was matter of fact with him. I tend to be a little animated, and I have to watch myself in that regard, not to be too big, to just keep it easy. And that's something that it took me many years to learn, and I try to keep that in mind. I just say to him, have you changed? Do you now look at all your CAT scans before you do the surgeries? He said, no, I don't. So you still don't look at them, right? No, I don't. I'd leave it at that. Stand closer to the jury, maybe give them a nod. Nothing big. And I can remember what I said at the end. He has two daughters, and he said that on his direct. And I said, I know that you have two daughters. Is that correct, doctor? And he said he did. I said to him, I imagine they are precious to you, are they not? And he said, yes, and I sat down. But in a nice way, and just, I don't think juries like you roughing people up, no matter what the circumstances.
I agree. Well, James, Tom, this has been awesome. Anything else you want anybody to know about this case, or that you want to impart any words of wisdom or advice, or have we squeezed the orange for all it's worth on this case?
James has lots of wisdom in this area. He's taking care of things more and more often now. I'll be 76 in February. So how long
I hope I'm ripping seven-figure verdicts when I'm in my 70s, Tom. So that's really awesome to hear. I love it. You guys are busy guys, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I know a lot of people were interested in understanding some of the nuances of the case, how it unfolded and so forth. So I appreciate you sharing that with all of us, and I wish you guys continued success in the future. Yeah, just thanks so much for doing the podcast, and hopefully there'll be another one in the future. We'll do it again. Okay, guys?
That would be great.
If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to the Just Verdicts podcast on your favorite platform and consider leaving a review. And if you're interested in co-counseling, local counseling, or referring a catastrophic injury case, we'd love to work with you. Call us at 412-281-4100 or visit our attorney referral page at pamedmal.com/refer. Thanks for listening.